today for the next few minutes. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today, for the next few minutes, we spend some time with one of the world's most beautiful and majestic and perhaps misunderstood creatures, the buffalo. We're going to be talking about a wonderful book called A Buffalo in the House, The True Story of a Man, an Animal, and the American West. This is the true story of a modern husband and wife whose paths crossed with an orphaned buffalo and of their loving attempts to raise that buffalo as best they could and of how it continued to be a very important part of their life. And right amidst that story is also the important story of the history of the buffalo and how it once dominated the American landscape and then was very savagely eradicated, nearly to the point of extinction. And it is about conflicts which go on to this very day between those who want each and every buffalo preserved at all costs and those who do not think twice about eliminating any buffaloes that stray where they are, do not exactly belong. A very, very compelling story indeed, told by the author R.D. Rosen. His past books include Psychobabble. In fact, he's responsible for that term. And he has done work for all kinds of different things, including Saturday Night Live and HBO's Not Necessarily the News. Again, this book is called A Buffalo in the House. The book is published by The New Press. And R.D. Rosen, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, and thank you for that very thorough introduction. I couldn't have said it better.
Well, thank you very much. It's interesting. This, in some ways, marks something of a departure from you, for you, if people know you mostly from some of your more humorous books and humorous projects. Tell us, first of all, if this folds nicely into other aspects of your life, or if it indeed this seems like as much of a departure as it appears at first glance.
Well, I began as a serious writer, more serious writer in my 20s, and then digressed, so to speak, into humor and comedy. And it may seem like a departure for people who might know me as one of the co-authors of Bad Cat, Bad Dog, Bad President, Bad Baby, those books. But actually, it's a return to my roots as a reporter and essayist. Which isn't to say it's not a different kind of book, because it really is. I've never written a book like this. It almost told me how to write it. I didn't go looking for the story of a love affair between a middle-aged man and a bison. It dropped in my lap, or I should say, I just stumbled on it. And once I did, I recognized it as this fantastic kind of plum that had dropped in my lap. And without thinking really twice about it, I plunged ahead because I felt there was so much material there, so much richness.
Hmm. You say at some point, it might be at the very end, I think, as you're kind of acknowledging people and talking about writing the story, that your introduction to this buffalo named Charlie came out of a series of what you call suspiciously unlikely circumstances. Tell us a little about that.
I had never been to Santa Fe. I grew up in Chicago, just south of where you are now, and lived in Boston and now live in Manhattan. I'm very much a transplanted Midwesterner to the East Coast, and I was visiting in Santa Fe, and I was at a brunch, and I was standing next to a woman making conversation with her. I'd never met her before, and when I asked her what she did, she said she was a chiropractor for large mammals. And I said, oh, that's very interesting. Who's your most interesting client? And she said, a lame buffalo. And I said, oh, that I would have to see. I thought she might have been joking. And she said, just a second. She went and made a phone call and came back and said, get in the car. And so I jumped in the car with my wife and with her brother and sister-in-law. And within a few minutes, I was standing at a fence, at a corral, at a ranch belonging to Roger Brooks and Burl Goodnight, and I was being licked by an 1,800-pound buffalo. And I don't know when you were last licked by a buffalo, but it's an extraordinary experience, because first of all, they go for your crotch immediately. And their heads are as big as Volkswagens, and it's like being licked by a mastodon. You're looking into the past. It's really quite extraordinary. So the idea that I had run into these people on the basis of a casual conversation in a place where I had never been before with a woman I'd only met a year before. I mean, there were lots of little things converging on this. But, you know, life is all about these somewhat random forces converging somewhere or with someone. So it wasn't so much that I ended up being licked by a buffalo, but that 2 days later I woke up and thought, my goodness, this is one of the best stories I've ever heard, and it's completely true, because the reason they had the buffalo is because Verl, who's a famous Western sculptor, had just learned that an ancestor of hers, Charles Goodnight, famous Texas rancher in the 19th century, had done something very remarkable with his wife. They had helped save the entire buffalo species from extinction, because it was the 1870s, Charles Goodnight and his wife were big fans of buffalo, although they were cattle people. But they noticed that the buffalo were all gone. I mean, almost anybody would notice that. Between the end of the Civil War in 1882, we finished off basically the last 20 or 30 million buffalo, which itself is an extraordinary fact. Mm. So they decided they would start a little herd themselves. They roped out two calves, a boy and a girl, and they bred them. And this fact, I mean, if it hadn't been for them and a few other people, we wouldn't have buffalo today, believe it or not. Hmm. She wanted to make a sculpture of Marianne Goodnight bottle feeding those first two calves. But Verl works from life, so she needed a buffalo calf to model for. And she put out the call, and a rancher acquaintance of her called and said, I have a one-day-old buffalo calf who's been separated from his mom. Do you want to come get him? And they did. They flew up to Idaho, got him, and she began working on her sculpture while a model, you know, literally was nursing this one-week-old buffalo calf with a bottle. And that's how they came to have Charlie. But when I met him, he was already 2 years old, and a lot had happened, including the fact that when they had fallen in love with him, he'd become part of their family. He was literally in their house most of the day when he was younger, but then when they tried to introduce him to a herd, because, you know, you can't keep a buffalo forever, there had been a terrible accident. Charlie, the buffalo, had freaked out, run into a fence, paralyzed himself, and this is at about the age of 7 months, and they brought him back into the family to teach him to walk again, which is why he was a lame buffalo. And the woman I talked to had been his chiropractor. I mean, the whole thing was so fantastic, Greg, I can't tell you.
Right. So this is kind of at the point that you crossed paths with these folks, or shortly thereafter, when the woman you'd met had given some help to Charlie, and he was a bit more up on his feet. So you think a day or two later about approaching them and asking them if you can capture this story, and I suppose to some extent sort of insinuate yourselves into their lives to write more thoroughly and reflectively about this experience which they were having. You talk about the fact that they could have so easily said no to you for so many reasons, but partly because you were not from that part of the country, and you might very well have been someone that might have sort of mistreated that story, but something told them to trust you, that you would do right by this story.
And I think it was the fact, honestly, that when I came back to talk to them and say, look, you don't know me, I don't know you, I want to do a book. I'm a writer from back east, and I think this would make a great book. Their dogs, they had four at the time, three of the four dogs were kind of crowded around me, sniffing and licking me, and I was petting them. I'm a big animal lover, and animals tend to like me. And I think that sealed the deal.
They thought, this is
a guy who loves animals. He'll do this right.
Very good. It was actually something of a rarity to find a bottle baby like this among buffaloes. Someplace in the book you talk of that doesn't really happen all that often. I mean, very seldom do buffalo abandon their babies. So Roger and Verrill were fortunate that one was found that could be part of their household.
That, in fact, was one of the other unusual circumstances, that they did find a buffalo baby. Buffalo are very, very smart animals. They make cattle look like idiots. One of the things that buffalo don't do is abort babies very often. They don't abandon babies. So something has to happen, really, to separate a buffalo mom from her calf. And in this case, there was a big herd up in Idaho on this buffalo ranch, and the cowboys were moving the herd from one pasture to another. And somehow this one-day-old calf was separated from his mom. And the thing about buffalo, I suppose you could say this is a parental flaw, is that if it's a choice between staying with your herd, which is your large family, and separating yourself from your herd to look for a baby, you'll go with the herd. And that's what happened. And the buffalo was left behind. It was found walking along a dirt road at one day old. You know, buffalo are very self-sufficient when they're born, and within half an hour or so, they're up on their feet. So they're not totally helpless. But this baby buffalo had to immediately be taken into the house and bottle-fed in Idaho, and he began his new life. And, you know, there are people who say, don't tamper with nature. If a buffalo is separated from its mother and it can't survive, well, so be it. You know, they don't want people to be taking animals out of the wild. Well, first of all, this was not a wild buffalo herd. It was on a ranch and fenced in. And second of all, who among us would not want to save a helpless baby animal if we could? And that's what this couple did. They did it for a larger reason, which was for Verrill to commemorate what her ancestors had done. But, you know, the real dilemma came when Charlie hurt himself, and he really couldn't walk. And the vet up at Colorado College that looked at him first said, you know, he'll be lucky if he ever stands up again. And that's a situation which almost anybody in their right mind would put an animal down. Because an animal who can't stand has no kind of life, and it's dangerous to other people. But by this point, 7 months into Charlie's life, they loved him so dearly, they didn't feel they had any choice.
I guess that's part of what this story is all about, the compulsion of real love. We're talking with R.D. Rosen, and we're talking about his book called A Buffalo in the House. Let's step back for a moment from this personal story of Roger and his wife and this baby buffalo, Charlie, which they take in, and talk for a moment about the historic place of buffalo in American history, because this is something else in your book that is so fascinating and also tremendously troubling. Help our listeners understand, first of all, just how many buffalo there were once upon a time.
There's some debate over it, but we think at one point there were probably 50 or 60 million buffalo roaming in the United States, and they were in every state but Upper New England. And I'm talking now about the 18th century, 17th century. When America was colonized, the buffalo east of the Mississippi slowly began to disappear. And then they disappeared west of the Rockies in the early 19th century because, as the Oregon Trail filled with a constant flow of people who needed to be fed. On top of which you had all these Indian cultures, American Indian cultures, that were utterly dependent on the buffalo for food, shelter, fuel, for their tools, for their ornaments. And one of the reasons that, let me just back up and say, by the Civil War, we only had buffalo in the Great Plains. And maybe we had 20 or 30 million of them. And at the end of the Civil War, and I love this fact, we had more buffalo in this country than people. The buffalo ran this place, and that was one of the many, many factors that sealed their fate. There were parts of this country where they simply covered the ground for as far as the eye could see. They had herds that were in the hundreds of thousands.
You said there were places where the buffaloes weren't just on the land, they seemed to be the land. And you said if you couldn't see them, you could hear them coming well in advance, an apocalypse on hooves.
And the apocalypse may be a slightly grandiose word, but the fact is buffalo in the aggregate, and sometimes individually, can be very destructive animals. They ignore fences, they ignore crops, they go pretty much where they want. So you can't say, gee, we should have saved all the buffalo, because if we had, we probably would have only buffalo still in this country and no people. It's very hard to establish a civilization if you have millions and millions of buffalo.
And you talk, of course, of how of clearing the frontier for our settlement meant, of course, clearing it of Native Americans, which meant also clearing it of buffalo. Because, as you say, buffalo were, in a sense, the foundation of the entire culture of the Plains Indians, their chief source of food, shelter, clothing, fuel, ceremonial products, art, commerce. Plains Indians had more than 80 uses for the buffalo, which meant that they were valuable to them even in death, or especially in death.
Especially in death. And the most Indian religions, of course, treated buffalo as a great, great gift from the Great Spirit or from nature. They had mythologies about where buffalo came from. Buffalo was the oxygen of most of the Plains tribe Indian culture. So, and everybody knew that if you got rid of the Indians, you got rid of the Indians. In fact, if you go back to even George Washington, decades before, he said on the subject of westward expansion that the objective was, and here I'm quoting, the total destruction and devastation of their settlements. This unfortunate race have, by their own unexpected desertion and ferocious barbarities, justified extermination. So it was official policy in the 19th century to get rid of the Indians by getting rid of the buffalo.
It's interesting, too, that that as history progresses through the 19th century, that certain technologies hastened the process. I mean, things like the development of the steamboat, which hastened the infiltration of people into the West, and the improvement of firearms. And you say eventually the Transcontinental Railroad dealing what you call the buffalo a brutal triple blow.
It was the trifecta, because the Transcontinental Railroad created access to these herds, so it was easier to get there and shoot them. And by the way, shooting a buffalo has been likened to shooting a parked car. It's really no more difficult if you have a good weapon.
And yet it became something of a game. I mean, people would entertain themselves shooting buffalo from moving trains. Tell us a little bit about when and how this was done.
It was in the 1860s and 1870s that shooting buffalo was a kind of sport. And if you could afford it, you would go out west with a guide, you would get on a train, and the train would slow down or park when you got inside of a buffalo herd. Sometimes you couldn't go any further because the buffalo herd was on the tracks. And they would supply you with guns, often sharpshooters, Sharp's rifles, which had been developed a little earlier and were one of the buffalo's great nemeses, because for the first time you could kill a buffalo at several hundred yards. You didn't have to even bother to creep up on them. So you had like safaris in which the wealthier Americans, and this sometimes included dignitaries from Europe, who of course were obsessed with our American West, would stick their heads and their rifles out of train windows and shoot buffalo at a distance of 5 feet or 10 feet or 15 feet. And not because they were going to profit from the meat or the hides or any of the things that the Indians relied on in the buffalo. It was just a sport. It was just a sport. Hmm. But I wanted to go back 1 minute to the Transcontinental Railroad, because it not only created access, but it created transportation for buffalo products back to the east. And everybody who was working on the railroad had to be fed. So you had a lot of needs that were all met by the buffalo. And you had mentioned new technologies. I mean, one of the technologies that created a huge market for buffalo that really hadn't existed before was in the 18, I don't remember all my dates, but the 1870s, early 70s, new tanning processes for buffalo hides were developed in England and America. Before that, people really couldn't work with the buffalo hide. It was too supple. But they figured out how to tan it, to make it tougher, and it became the first choice for belting leather, that is, belts that ran the machines of the Industrial Revolution. And suddenly you had tremendous demand for buffalo hide. Hmm. As a result, people from all over America who had nothing better to do came out west to shoot buffalo, and it was said that if you were any good at it, and that meant killing 50 or 60 or 100 buffalo a day, that you made more money than President Grant.
Well, and one thing that is so troubling,
like Silicon Valley.
Yeah, right. Well, it's a couple things come to mind. One is, you know, how ironic for this thing which we think of as an icon of our distant past being part of the Industrial Revolution, which reshaped the world. I mean, just the idea that of buffalo being indiscriminately killed in order to be a cog in the new industrial machine just is so incredible to think about. And you talk about how this frenzy of killing buffalo for money became such that soon these animal carcasses would just be sort of left there to rot, not even worth the effort of butchering once the bison had been skinned. I mean, right. that's what this killing was for. I mean, it really upsetting to think about this. And, of course, it didn't take all that long for Americans to realize what was happening. You tell us of even by the 1880s, there are widespread acts of legislation to try to stem this terrible tide. So it is not just in the modern day that we suddenly woke up to the demise of the buffalo. I mean, it was too late, but it came earlier than a lot of us probably might realize, a realization that this had gone too far, fast.
I like to say, when these little bits of legislation were proposed, the buffalo was already out of the barn, and he was dead. So it was very much ex post facto. And the fact that it took people like Charles Goodnight and his wife, and a very, very few other people who by accident or design started their own herds, the fact that you needed that kind of serendipitous rescue operation to save the buffalo is the greatest evidence that although people may have understood what was happening and cared, nobody did anything. They just kept killing. And people like to say, well, the American Indian wasted the buffalo, too. They killed their share of buffalo. But the thing is, for the most part, they killed their share of buffalo so that they could survive, and they used most parts of that buffalo. And although there may have been a little wanton killing of buffalo on their part, and partly in response to seeing that everybody else was wiping out their buffalo, so they figured we better kill as many as we can for our own purposes. The fact is, it was the white settlers who killed for profit and who took this animal completely for granted, because it only had monetary worth to them. It didn't have any cultural or emotional value.
It was a commodity.
It was a commodity.
Hmm. We're speaking with R.D. Rosen, author of A Buffalo in the House. One thing that is very striking in your book is that we are told not only of this modern couple of Roger and Verrill, who love this orphan buffalo that they take in, but in sort of an interesting parallel, we see another love story told, and that is of this man who does so much to try to save the buffalo, Charles Goodnight, and the very tender story of his wife, Mary, who is at his side and who ends up being taken into places and into a life which she surely never anticipated, and yet which she participated in fully and enthusiastically at her husband's mm-hmm. side. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, it's very true. She came from Charles Goodnight married up and Marianne married down. She was from a much better educated family of teachers and politicians. And she fell in love with Charles Goodnight, who took her to the panhandle of Texas, which was really completely undeveloped at the time. And it was very naked land. He was looking for a place to start a cattle ranch. And he found it in the Paladuro Canyon. And while he was establishing the ranch with a partner, Marianne Goodnight, who had grown up with a lot of culture, was keeping house in a shack in the middle of nowhere. Her husband was out during the day, and she had no company at all. And, in fact, finally, when they had a little money, she hired a New York artist to come down and to do paintings of their ranch, so she could have, you know, some ornaments in her house. But long before that, she was just trying to get by. And one of my favorite stories is that one of the cowboys working on the ranch once dropped off a sack of 3 chickens for her, thinking this would make a lovely meal. But she was so lonely, she looked on these chickens as potential companions and didn't kill them, let them run around the house, and then talked about the conversation she was having with these chickens. They became her best friends during the day. So she sacrificed quite a lot, and it's a testament to her character, not only that she survived, but that she then cared so much about the buffalo, this animal whose death she could hear every day. She could hear the gunshots.
And you say that was one thing in this new life that she could never get used to, the endless killing of the buffalo.
And the another interesting parallel, Greg, is that she then said to Charles, honey, let's do something about it. And Charles said, I've dealt with buffalo before. They're very difficult, but maybe you're right, honey. Let's get a couple. And then 130 years later, Burl Goodnight, Charles' ancestor, says to Roger, honey, I'd like to make a sculpture commemorating Roger and Marianne. Do you mind if I get a buffalo calf?
I like that side of the story. I want to read something which you include in your book, which is so beautiful. This is the inscription on a clock, which Mr. Goodnight gave to his wife in appreciation for all that she had withstood. Yeah. In honor of Mrs. Mary Dyer Goodnight, pioneer of the Texas Panhandle, for many months in 1876-77, she saw few men and no women, her nearest neighbor being 75 miles distant and the nearest settlement 200 miles. She met isolation and hardships with a cheerful heart and danger with undaunted courage. With unfailing optimism, she took life's varied gifts and made her home a house of joy. I mean, that is really astonishing to read. I mean,
but the rest of us husbands in place.
Right. Well, and it's astonishing in a couple of different ways. But one of them is of course, that she did something great, of course, but she is by no means alone. And one wonders how many husbands had that level of profound understanding and appreciation for maybe what they had put their wives through, and of the contribution which the wife made to their new life out in the West. I mean, one hopes that there was more of that kind of appreciation than we might think there was.
Well, he was, Charles Goodnight seems to have been a very remarkable man. He did something very late in his life that showed a tremendous generosity and sensitivity to other people. He lived to be 93, by the way, which is fascinating because he never ate vegetables. He basically ate meat and drank coffee his whole life. But when he was 93, within 6 months of his death, he realized that friends of his who were Taos Pueblo Indians up in New Mexico, he was a great friend of the Indians later in life, even though he was at war with them early in his life. He realized the Taos Pueblo Indians, who continued to have buffalo ceremonies every year, even though there had been no buffalo for years, they continued to have ceremonies in an attempt to bring back the buffalo and the abundance of the past. Charles Goodnight realized the Taos Pueblo Indians, his friends, did not have any buffalo tallow, which was part of the ceremony. Now, Charles Goodnight had a herd because those two original calves now were several hundred head. He donated 18 of his buffalo to the Taos Pueblo Indians simply for the purpose of providing them with some buffalo to provide them with tallow for the ceremony. So he shipped them from Texas to New Mexico, and the Taos Pueblo thanked him in letters, which I quote in the book. And those buffalo, that gift from Charles Goodnight, which he gave at a point in his life when he really could not afford anything. He didn't have any money at the end of his life, believe it or not. Those buffalo became the foundation of a herd of buffalo that the Taos Pueblo have to this day in Taos, New Mexico. And I think that's kind of an extraordinary thing.
Absolutely.
You're looking after your friends to be part of, you know, so to speak, the race that destroyed the buffalo, the single greatest slaughter of living things, with perhaps one exception, and to, at the end of his life, think about making some sort of amends, which he did.
Amazing. Let's turn our attention to this modern-day couple who took in this orphan buffalo, whom they called Charlie. What a wonderful couple they are, Verl and Roger. And in some respects, they seemed so well-equipped for this incredible experience which they were to have, and especially Roger, who you describe as being sort of built like a linebacker, and that would, of course, come in handy in dealing with Charlie. And of course, the day would rapidly come when not even a linebacker was going to be physically able to really control this extraordinary animal.
These two people, you couldn't have designed a better couple for this role. I want to emphasize that the word pet should never enter into this discussion. A buffalo is not a pet. No wild animal is a pet. If anybody knew it, it was Roger and Verl. Verl has a license as a wildlife rehabilitation person, so that means if you find an abandoned bear cub, she's one of the people you call to take care of the cub for the winter until they can find a home for it. They're very savvy about wild animals. Roger is a major horseman. Commercial pilot was his career, but he's always dealt with animals, so they knew what they were getting themselves into. And this really became important as Charlie grew, because they're very cute, just like chimps are very cute at the beginning of their lives. And then their instinctual nature takes over, and as friendly as they may be, and Charlie was one of those animals who just was by nature incredibly friendly and tolerant. Nonetheless, if you cross him, and you might not always know when you cross Charlie or irritated, he might think nothing of goring you. And there are a lot of incidents in recorded buffalo human history of buffalo who had lived with their owners for a long time turning on them and killing them. So there's a definite risk, a real risk, and a lot of Verl and Charlie's friends said, Verl and Roger's friends said, you guys are nuts. Are you sure you know what you're dealing with? And Roger said, yes, I think I do. Roger had earlier in his life been a negotiator for the pilots union and had to deal with the FAA and other agencies. And he said, don't you think that a guy who's dealt with the Federal Aviation Administration can deal with a single buffalo? And he, in fact, had to change his approach to Charlie as Charlie grew older. There are a lot of people, as you know, who acquire exotic animals and don't understand that it requires them to adapt to the animal, not just, you know, the animal to adapt to them. So when Charlie reached puberty, Roger had to be much more careful. And in fact, there's a period where he wouldn't even take Charlie for walks anymore because he'd become so unpredictable. Now, for a lot of people, if an animal starts to mature and become more aggressive, the first thing they want to do is give the animal away. Well, this is not what I wanted. But Roger knew what he was getting into.
He knew that this was in the future and was sort of prepared to deal with it and to change for it.
What he thought was in the future was that after Charlie's modeling career was over, they would repatriate him. That's not the word, but they would find a herd and put him in that herd when he was a few months old. They didn't count on a couple of things. One is that they fell madly in love with this animal, and he was such an unusual animal. So I think they held on to him a bit longer than they might otherwise, because he did remain tractable and a happy member of the family for longer. So they didn't count on falling in love with him. And then when they finally did introduce him to a herd, they certainly didn't count on the tragedy that ensued.
Well, and you know, it's interesting.
Night. Yeah. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's fine. We'll get to that in just a second. Let's talk for just a moment about what life was like in this home with Charlie before they do attempt to take him off to join another buffalo herd. One of the things that was evident very close, very early on, is that Charlie always wanted to be close to Roger as much as possible. Wherever he went, the buffalo was sure to follow. And of course, as you've already alluded to, the bigger Charlie got, the more complicated even that simple fact became.
Well, these many animals will imprint on humans, as you know, or on each other. And it's well known. There's anecdotes through history of buffalo who, in the absence of a buffalo parent, will imprint on a horse or a person. It'd be hard to raise a buffalo herd as the original Goodnights did if it weren't for that fact. So Charlie imprinted in a big way on Roger. And it's not clear whether he saw Roger as a buffalo or what, but he loved Roger. He became very focused on Roger. And Roger, in turn, Verl and Roger don't have children, so they have lots of time to love and care for their animal. And Roger became a buddy. I mean, it wasn't just that he enjoyed the fact that Charlie liked him. Roger genuinely liked being around Charlie. And so Charlie was in the house a lot, but of course, as Charlie grew bigger, he didn't know he was getting bigger. So, but his life in the house became much more problematic for Roger and Verl, because now he couldn't turn around in tight spaces. When he had a, you know, quote unquote accident in the house, it was a puddle the size of a lake. I think the funniest story, and absolutely true, is the night that he was introduced to three Japanese people, one of Verl's art collectors and his elderly parents, and they really wanted to meet a buffalo. Really, really wanted to meet a buffalo. So they're sitting on the couch. Verl brings Charlie to the door of the living room, and Charlie gets very, very excited and in effect, starts charging them in his excitement, not his aggression. And these three visitors scatter. I mean, the kind of thing that you wouldn't dare put in a sitcom because it's just a little bit too ridiculous. In Santa Fe, it happened.
We should mention that although there were accidents of all kinds and so on, that there were a few very pleasant surprises with Charlie besides his very loving nature. One of them, you say, that Charlie was not only amazingly good-natured but also sweet-smelling, that Roger thought he smelled like fresh laundry. He smelled better than the dogs and the cats and was better company, too.
This is one of many extraordinary things about buffalo, like the fact that they can jump 6 feet high, even as 2,000-pound adults. They have fantastic leaping ability. They also, the whole species, doesn't smell. which is ridiculous given the fact that they wallow a lot. They roll around on the dirt and sometimes in their own urine, and they don't look like the cleanest animal, yet they have no smell. I'm not talking about putting your face in their mouth, but every other part of them is wonderfully smelling. And Roger was so impressed by this because it seemed like an interesting example of how misunderstood this animal was, how demonized they've been and thought to be a kind of prehistoric menace.
Well, and I suppose it's interesting. They are a menace when there are too many of them or if they're in the wrong place. But one-on-one, there's nothing more beautiful and perhaps nothing more gentle than a buffalo.
And even in herds. Now, America is a developed nation. You can't have hundreds of thousands of buffalo roaming around, of course. But there are places in this country where you do have herds that are fenced in. And there are many more places in this country, particularly in the Great Plains, which are economically depressed, where a lot of the land is utterly useless, where an increasing number of environmentalists think we should have buffalo roaming wildly because there's nothing else there. So really, one of the big issues now that we're not determined to kill all the buffalo again, although we are slaughtering some, one of the issues is where should the buffalo be allowed to roam in this country?
One of the most interesting stories besides that of Charlie himself and his brushes with death and his amazing recovery and so on is something you just touched on, the fact that there have been some very unsettling cases of buffalo being killed in recent years, particularly right on the doorstep of Yellowstone National Park by employees of the Montana Department of Livestock. You don't have too much kind to say about the DOL agents. And you say leaving the swashbuckling DOL agents in charge of buffalo who cross that border of Yellowstone in search of food was a little like letting a group of professional wrestlers teach a class of rambunctious school children. Someone's going to get hurt, and it won't be the adults.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about this sad story and where it has all led.
Well, it's very complicated, as any controversy tends to be. So let me just give you the outline of it. It's an unresolved situation, and it pits the buffalo of Yellowstone National Park against not only the agents of the Montana Livestock Department, but other cattle growers and cattle interests. And the issue is this. We know that buffalo are the enemy of cattle historically, in the sense that if you want to be a cattle rancher, you can't have a bunch of buffalo going wherever they want. So that goes back to the very origins of the cattle industry. You know, bison are a problem. But what you have now is a herd of buffalo in Yellowstone National Park, which is the only continuously wild herd of buffalo left in this country. In the 1870s, late 1870s, a few buffalo, and I mean maybe a dozen or so, found their way into Yellowstone National Park and hid there. They managed to escape extermination and became the basis of a herd. Today that herd varies between 3,000 and 4,000 head. Now, in the spring, the buffalo who have survived the winter come out of the park on the west side looking for lower elevations where there's, you know, some early spring grass where they can give birth. Once they leave Yellowstone Park on the west side, they are in Montana. They've left Wyoming. They're in Montana. For some reason, the federal government gave jurisdiction over those buffalo to the Montana Department of Livestock. This was several years ago. Department of Livestock is in charge of livestock, not wild animals. So you've given the power to control or deal with these wandering buffalo to the very people who most dislike buffalo. So the inevitable has happened. There's been a lot of capturing and killing of these Yellowstone buffalo, these beautiful animals. Now, the the Department of Livestock and a lot of other agencies and the cattle interests say they're doing it to protect their cattle, the Montana cattle, from being infected by the bison with an infectious disease called brucellosis, which ironically was brought over to America by European cattle. Anyway, it's common for bison to carry it, common for elk to carry it. The fact is, though, that no bison has ever, in the wild, infected a cattle with brucellosis. It's very hard to do it. The cattle has to lick the aborted fetus of a buffalo. Calf has to do it within 3 or 4 hours of the aborted delivery. It never happens. Brucellosis is a serious disease, but it's not really transmitted to cattle. Yet, they are using this as the justification for capturing and killing buffalo that wander out of Yellowstone Park. We have to protect our cattle from brucellosis.
It amounts to keeping certain children out of public swimming pools for fear of catching the AIDS virus. I mean,
That's a great analogy.
It would be a comparable sort of risk.
If you took the children you suspected of carrying the AIDS virus, if you took them out, put them in a little pen next to the swimming pool, tested them, and then slaughtered them. That's what's happening.
Wow.
I don't mean to equate the life of a buffalo with the life of a child, but in terms of the irrationality of the justification, it's pretty much the same.
Wow.
The one thing that people are afraid of out west, really, underneath the brucellosis, fake brucellosis issue, the one thing they're afraid of is that buffalo will take over, that if we let them out of Yellowstone Park, if we let them wander, we will somehow return to a state we were in the 19th century where buffalo ruled the land. That's not likely to happen.
Well, that makes this book especially interesting in that we have this really, I think for most people, it will be a very troubling story of modern-day slaughter set against the really tender love story of Roger and Verl and this buffalo named Charlie, which they take in. Into their home, and eventually of what occurs, and of the friendships which spring out of this wonderful encounter. I think one of the most interesting moments when Roger is trying to explain this powerful connection that he feels to Charlie, it comes just at the moment that he's about to temporarily give him up. He says, "Buffalo are like the ghosts of American history. Being with Charlie is like touching the past." And so it is, in a sense, to even read about the buffalo who are still among us. I'm sure for you as the author, it was a similar sort of experience.
Absolutely. The minute I met Charlie, the minute he was licking my forearm, and I was looking into the huge eyes of this creature, I did have that sort of feeling that this was a window into a piece of the past I knew I didn't know about. Wanted to know about. A lot of us read about buffalo and they're shooting them from trains in seventh grade. That's it. We learned there were once a lot of buffalo. There aren't anymore. And here I was, a middle-aged man, being licked by a buffalo and thinking, wait a second, I want to know more about this. And the minute I began to look into the history, I felt that it was important for me to braid this love story with that history, simply because human beings have very short memories. We all live our lives as if the past hasn't happened most of the time. And I thought this was, I'm a guy who gave no thought to buffalo before I met Charlie. But once I did, I thought, you know what? We have to tell this story again.
The story is told in this book called A Buffalo in the House, The True Story of a Man, an Animal, and the American West. It's published by The New Press, the author, R.D. Rosen. Mr. Rosen, I'm so glad you wrote this wonderful book, and I'm glad we could talk about it so thoroughly on the morning show. My best wishes to you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Tomorrow on the morning show, Dr. Art Sear joins us from Carthage College to talk about current events.
Support for WGTD comes from Premier Barbers and Stylists, 8064 North 76th Street in Milwaukee, reminding you that many traffic accidents are the result of drivers on their cell phones. Whether you're talking or texting, cell phone usage while driving has become a serious problem. Premier Barbers and Stylists